that, in his opinion, the circumstances were not ripe for a targeted killing. We needed to wait a bit and create a trap of our own, not just shoot people in the street. "Give me a month," I told him. "I'll carry out the mission, and no one will know that I was even here." But Harrell wouldn't listen. On January 21, he dismissed the birds and called in Mifratz, the Mossad-targeted killing unit commanded by Yitzhak Shamir, in order to have Kleinwächter done away with. What Harrell didn't know was that Valentin had grasped that Kleinwächter would be the Mossad's next target. He gave him a series of briefings, made sure he was constantly accompanied by an escort, and gave him an Egyptian military pistol. On February 20, a Mossad lookout saw Kleinwächter setting out alone on the road from Loch to Basel. They decided to make the hit when he got back. Shamir, who, together with Harrell, commanded the operation in the field, assigned the job of firing the shots to a trained former Irgun assassin by the name of Akiva Cohen. Harrell sent the German-speaking Zvi Acharoni along with him. They waited for the target to get back in the evening, but he didn't show up, and it was decided to call the operation off. Then everything went wrong. Kleinwächter finally did appear, and the cancellation order was suddenly reversed, but the execution of the entire action was hasty and amateurish. The Mifratz operative's car blocked Kleinwächter's, but the way both vehicles had stopped on the narrow road prevented the Mossad men from getting away after the operation. Acharoni got out of the car and went up to Kleinwächter, as if to ask him for directions. The idea was to get him to open the window. He began doing so. Cohen, who approached Acharoni from behind, drew his gun, tried to aim it through the open window, and fired. But the bullet hit the glass and shattered it, and then hit Kleinwächter's scarf. But it missed his body. For some unknown reason, the pistol didn't fire again. One theory is that the spring snapped, another is that the bullet was a dud, and yet another is that the magazine got loose and fell out. Acharoni saw that the plan had failed and yelled at everyone to make a run for it. They couldn't use their car, so they ran off in different directions to try to get to waiting escape vehicles. Kleinwächter drew his pistol and began firing at the fleeing Israelis. He didn't hit anyone, but the entire operation was an embarrassing failure. Harrell then launched a number of actions aimed at intimidating the scientists and their families, including anonymous letters threatening their lives and containing much information about them, as well as actual visits in the middle of the night to give similar warnings. These operations also failed dismally when the Swiss police arrested a Mossad operative by the name of Joseph Bengal after he threatened Professor Gerke's daughter, Heidi. He was extradited to Germany, convicted, and sentenced to a short term in prison. Mossad agents following the trial had the disagreeable experience of watching as the missile project's security officer, the hulky Hermann Valentin, appeared at the proceedings with a smug smile, not even pretending to hide his pistol. By the spring of 1963, Harrell's Mossad hadn't slowed, let alone ended, the Egyptians' progress toward rockets that could annihilate Israel. So Harrell then took to political subterfuge. He began leaking stories to the press, some true, some embellished, some outright lies, that the Germans were helping Egypt produce atom bombs and deadly lasers, about Nazis building weapons for Arabs to kill Jews. Harrell was totally convinced that the German scientists were Nazis still determined to complete the final solution, and that the German authorities were aware of their activities, but were doing nothing to stop them. The truth was that there were people who had become accustomed to the good life under the Third Reich, had become unemployed when it fell, and now were simply trying to make some easy money off the Egyptians. But Harrell dragged the entire organization, and in fact the whole country, behind this obsession of his. In order to prove his claims, Harrell presented information gathered in Cairo about a Dr. Hans Eisele, the butcher of Buchenwald, who'd been involved in appalling experiments on Jewish inmates. He was designated a war criminal but escaped trial and found a comfortable refuge in Egypt, where he became the physician of the German scientists. Harel also fingered a number of other Nazis in Cairo, though none of them belonged to the group of missile scientists. His goal was to publicly vilify Germany, with which Israel had a complicated relationship, a subject of much dispute internally. Relative moderates such as Ben-Gurion and his chief aide, Shimon Peres, maintained that at a time when the United States was reluctant to provide Israel with all the military and economic aid it asked for, Israel could not afford to turn down assistance from the West German government, which came in the form of a reparations and compensation agreement and the sale of military equipment at a fraction of its real cost. Hardliners such as Golda Meir and Harel himself, on the other hand, rejected the notion that the Federal Republic of Germany was a new or different Germany. History, to their minds, had left a permanent stain. Harel also called in the Editors Committee, that unique Israeli institution then composed of the top editors of the print and electronic media, who self-censored items in their publications at the request of the government. Harel asked the Editors Committee to provide him with three journalists, whom he subsequently recruited into the Mossad. They were sent to Europe, at the Mossad's expense, to gather intelligence about the front companies that were buying equipment for the Egyptian project. Harel claimed he needed the journalists for operational reasons, but the truth was that he wanted to use their involvement and the materials they collected to launder information he already possessed. As such, it could be disseminated to the foreign and Israeli media for the purpose of manufacturing newspaper reports that would create a climate suited to his purposes. Harel's stories generated a media frenzy and a growing sense of panic in Israel. Ben-Gurion tried to calm Harel down, to no avail. "He was not, in my opinion, quite sane," said Amos Manor, the Shin Bet chief at the time. "It was something much more profound than an obsession. You couldn't have a rational conversation about it with him." It ended, as most obsessions do, in Harel's own destruction. His publicity campaign, the frenzied newspaper stories he'd planted of Hitler's minions rising again, badly wounded Ben-Gurion. The Prime Minister was attacked for not having done enough to end the threat posed by the German scientists working in Egypt, a threat Israeli citizens saw as a clear and present danger to their very existence, and for leading his country into a conciliation with West Germany, which now seemed to be at least indirectly responsible for a new version of the Final Solution. On March 25, 1963, Ben-Gurion summoned Harel to his office and demanded an explanation for a number of actions Harel had carried out vis-à-vis the local and international media without Ben-Gurion's approval. The conversation degenerated into a bitter debate over the Israeli government's policy toward Germany. The Prime Minister reminded Harel that he was supposed to implement government policy, not set it. Offended by the rebuke, Harel offered his resignation, confident the old man couldn't manage without him, and would beg him to stay. Ben-Gurion thought otherwise. He accepted the resignation on the spot. Isser Harel's once brilliant career ended in a failed bluff and utter defeat. He was immediately replaced by Meir Amit, the chief of Amman. But it was too late for Ben-Gurion, too. Harel's campaign against the scientists had played into the hands of opposition leader Begin, who never let up his attacks on Ben-Gurion. Even inside his own party, Mapai, things had reached a boiling point. Ben-Gurion squabbled ceaselessly with Golda Meir, Harel's main supporter. Less than 2 months after replacing Harel, Ben-Gurion, convinced he'd lost the support of even his own party, resigned. He was replaced by Levi Eshkol. Meanwhile, Egypt was still tinkering with the guidance systems for the missiles that could have caused grave harm to Israel. Meir Amit, one of the IDF's brilliant young commanders, a planner of the 1956 Sinai campaign, who was responsible for advancing the military intelligence directorate by several generations, took over a Mossad in disarray. The agency was deeply demoralized. In the 9 months since Egypt had announced its 4 missile tests, The Israelis had learned precious little about the program, and everything the Mossad and Amman had tried thus far had failed to even slow the project, let alone dismantle it. Pressuring Germany, whether through Harel's self-immolating press campaign or Foreign Minister Golda Meir's fiery speeches to the Knesset, had made no difference. Later that summer, a strongly worded missive from Eshkol to Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, demanding immediate action to get the scientists back from Egypt, also failed to spur the Germans. As Israeli diplomats reported to the Foreign Ministry in Jerusalem, they could only assume that Adenauer and the leadership are preoccupied with more important problems, such as managing the Cold War and the post-Cuban Missile Crisis period. Amit set about rebuilding the organization, reinforcing it with the best personnel he knew from Amman. As soon as he took over, he ordered a halt to any matters that he considered extraneous, and the drastic reduction of the resources being devoted to the hunt for Nazi criminals, explaining that it was a matter of priorities. Before all else, we have to produce information about the enemies of the State of Israel nowadays. Amit knew he needed a tactical reset, and that the Mossad had to rethink its approach to the problem of Egyptian missiles. His first order, then, was for a shift away from targeted killing operations and for the vast majority of his resources to be focused instead on trying to understand what precisely was going on inside the missile project. Secretly, however, with most of the top officials of the organization out of the loop, he prepared a targeted killing project of his own against the scientists. Operations personnel were trying to find ways to send parcel bombs from inside Egypt, thereby significantly shortening the time between the sending and opening of the package. They tried out the method on a relatively easy target, the physician Hans Eisele. On September 25, there was a blast in the post office in the upscale Cairo neighborhood of Mahdi, when a letter bomb that had been addressed to Dr. Karl de Busch, the false name Eisele was using, exploded and blinded a postal worker. The failure of this operation convinced Amit that targeted killings should only be used very sparingly. If not as a last resort, then at the very least only after meticulous planning that would prevent embarrassing failures. Nevertheless, he ordered the Mossad to prepare plans to shoot, blow up, or poison the scientists in the event that the effort to solve the matter peacefully didn't work. Amit ordered that break-ins to all the offices connected to the missile project in Germany and Switzerland be stepped up, and as many documents as possible photographed. These operations were enormously complex. The sites were well guarded, both by Egyptian intelligence and by Hermann Valentin's men, in the hearts of crowded European cities, in countries where the law was strictly enforced. Mossad operatives burglarized the Egyptian embassies, the Egyptian purchasing mission in Cologne, and the Intra office in Munich. They broke into the Egypt Air office in Frankfurt no fewer than 56 times between August 1964 and December 1966. The information obtained in the break-ins, some 30,000 documents were photographed up to the end of 1964 alone, was important, but far from sufficient. The Mossad had to recruit someone on the inside of the missile project. This critical task was assigned to a division called Junction, Tzomet in Hebrew, which would become the Mossad's most important branch, responsible for bringing in the bulk of the organization's intelligence. Unlike in Hollywood movies and pulp fiction, most of this information is not collected directly by Mossad employees darting about in the shadows. Rather, it is gleaned from foreign nationals in their home countries. The Mossad case officers responsible for recruiting and operating these sources are called collection officers, Katza in the Hebrew acronym, and they are expert psychologists. They know how to persuade a person to betray everything and everyone he believes in, his friends and family, his organization, his nation. Unfortunately, though, none of them had been able to work their psychology on anyone close to the Egyptian program. Recruiting agents in Arab countries became a long-term strategic priority, but in the short run, with the clock ticking, Junction would have to look elsewhere. In April 1964, Amit sent Rafi Eitan to Paris, which served as the European nerve center of Israeli intelligence, to run Junction's operations on the continent. Up to this point, all of Junction's efforts to enlist one of the scientists had come to naught, mostly because of the rigid security precautions instituted by Valentin. From day to day, he was becoming more of a problem. The need to deal with Valentin would lead to the netting of a much bigger fish. Avraham Ayatov, Junction coordinator in Bonn, had an idea, and he presented it to Eitan in Paris in May 1964. He'd identified a dubious character who'd sold arms and intelligence to the Nasser regime, and who also was close to the German scientists. "There is just one small problem," Ayatov said. "The man's name is Otto Skorzeny, and he was a high-ranking Wehrmacht officer, Hitler's special operations commander, and a favorite of the Führer." "And you want to recruit this Otto?" Eitan asked sarcastically. "Wonderful." "There's one more small matter," Ayatov added. "He was a devoted Nazi and a member of the SS." In 1960, Ayatov told Eitan, Harel had ordered Amal, the unit that handled the hunt for Nazi war criminals, to gather as much information as possible about Skorzeny, with the goal of bringing him to justice or killing him. His file said he was an enthusiastic member of the Austrian Nazi Party at the age of 23, had enlisted in 1935 to a secret SS unit in Austria, and had taken part in the Anschluss, Hitler's annexation of Austria, and in Kristallnacht. He rose rapidly in rank of the Waffen-SS, becoming head of its special operations units. Sturmbannführer Skorzeny parachuted into Iran and trained local tribes to blow up oil pipelines serving the Allied armies, and he plotted to murder the Big Three, Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt. He also had a plan for abducting and killing General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was forced to spend Christmas 1944 surrounded by a heavy guard. Most famously, Skorzeny was selected personally by Hitler to lead the Gran Sasso raid, which successfully extricated the Führer's friend and ally, the former fascist dictator Benito Mussolini, from the Alpine Villa where he was being held prisoner by the Italian government. Allied intelligence called Skorzeny the most dangerous man in Europe. He was not, however, convicted of war crimes. He was acquitted by one tribunal, and after he was rearrested on other charges, he escaped with the help of his SS friends. He took refuge in Franco's Spain, from where he established profitable commercial relations with fascist regimes around the world and also maintained contact with the German scientists in Egypt. Skorzeny's acquaintance with the scientists in Egypt and the fact that he'd been a superior officer to Hermann Valentin during the war were enough, in Eitan's view, to justify trying to recruit him, despite his Nazi past. Eitan was not a Holocaust survivor, and he dealt with the matter, as was his wont, without emotional involvement. If it helped Israel, he thought, that would make it worth forgiveness. "And we could offer him in exchange something that no one else could," he told his colleagues. "Life without fear." Through a number of intermediaries, the Mossad established contact with Countess Ilse von Finkenstein, Skorzeny's wife. She would serve as the Mossad's entree. The Mossad file on the Countess says that she was a member of the aristocracy. She is a cousin of the German pre-war finance minister Hjalmar Schacht. She is 45, a fairly attractive woman, brimming over with energy. "She was involved in everything," said Raphael Rafi Medan, the German-born Mossad operative who was assigned to the mission. "She sold titles of nobility, had ties with Vatican intelligence, and sold arms as well. She and her husband also had liberal ideas about their relationship." "They didn't have children," Medan said, "and they maintained an open marriage. Ilse always looked stunning. Every 2 years, she underwent hormonal treatment in Switzerland in order to preserve her youth." Medan had had a reputation because of his European good looks for being able to influence women, according to the Mossad report on the affair. A meeting was set in late July 1964 in Dublin, Ireland. Medan introduced himself as an Israeli Defense Ministry employee on leave and looking for an opening in international tourism. He might be interested in taking part in the Bahamas development project that the Countess was involved in, he said. The Countess liked Maidan, and their relationship warmed up. When their business talk was over, she invited him to a party at her farm. This was the start of a series of meetings, including some wild visits nightclubbing all over Europe. According to a Mossad rumor that circulated for many years, and was gently hinted at in the reports but not explicitly stated, Maidan sacrificed himself for his country, and took advantage of the German couple's open marriage, by wooing the Countess and eventually taking her to bed. Maidan commented on this by saying, "There are things that gentlemen do not speak about," and described their encounter with a smile as good and even gratifying. In Madrid, on the night of September 7, Maidan told her that a friend of his from the Israeli Defense Ministry wanted to meet her husband about a very important matter. The friend was already in Europe and waiting for a reply. Convincing von Finkenstein to cooperate was not difficult. Only 4 years before, Israel had found, grabbed, tried, and executed Adolf Eichmann. There were powerful forces in the Jewish world, including Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal, engaged in worldwide campaigns to find and prosecute Nazis like Skorzeny. Maidan, therefore, was able to offer the Countess and, by extension, her husband, that life without fear. In the morning, when they were still groggy from the alcohol and smoke in the clubs, von Finkenstein informed Maidan happily that her husband was ready to meet his friend, that night, if possible. Maidan called Ayituv to Madrid. He set up a meeting in a hotel lobby that evening. The Countess came first, glamorously accoutred. 15 minutes later, the colonel appeared. Maidan introduced them to Ayituv. Then he took von Finkenstein aside for a business talk. Skorzeny stayed with Ayituv. The Mossad's internal final report on the affair, though written in dry professional language, could not overlook the intensity of the meeting. It is difficult to overstate Avraham Ayituv's emotional reluctance over this operation. Avraham is a scion of a religiously observant family, a native of Germany educated in a religious Jewish school. For him, the contact with a Nazi monster was a shocking emotional experience that went beyond the demands of the profession. In the detailed report Ayituv himself submitted on September 14, 1964, he described the talks he had that week with Skorzeny. Skorzeny was a giant, a hulk of a man. He was obviously remarkably strong physically. On his left cheek was the well-known scar from his pictures, reaching his ear. He was partly deaf in that ear, and asked me to sit on his right, well-dressed. 2 moments gave me a shock. Skorzeny was looking for a number in his phone book to give me. All of a sudden, he took a monocle out of his pocket and stuck it into his right eye socket. His appearance then, what with his bodily dimensions, the scar, and his aggressive gaze, made him look like the complete Nazi. The second incident happened after our meeting, when we were dining together in a restaurant near his office. Suddenly, someone came up to us, clicked his heels together loudly, and greeted him in German as "my general." Skorzeny told me that this was the owner of the restaurant, and he used to be one of the top Nazis in those parts. I have no illusions about his original opinions. Even his wife didn't try to clear him. She only stressed that he played no part in the Holocaust. Most of the conversation at the first meeting centered on political issues, on World War II and the Holocaust, East-West relations, and the Middle East situation. Ayituv brought up the issue of Skorzeny's participation in the Kristallnacht pogroms. He pulled out a long list of people who had taken part in the attacks and presented it to Skorzeny. Skorzeny was familiar with the document, which had been stored in Yad Vashem, because the accusation had been raised and discussed during the war crimes trial from which he had managed to escape. He pointed to an X inked next to his name. "That's proof that I did not participate," he said, though Nazi hunter Wiesenthal interpreted the mark as proof of just the opposite. Skorzeny complained that Wiesenthal was hunting him, and that more than once he had found himself in a situation where he feared for his life. Ahituv decided not to stretch the point too far, and did not argue. At a certain stage, Skorzeny got tired of talking about the war. He stopped me and asked me what my business was. It was clear that there was no point in playing hide-and-seek. I told him I was in the Israeli intelligence service. Skorzeny said that he wasn't surprised we had gotten to him. At different times he had been linked to different countries, and with some of them he still maintained excellent relations. He was definitely prepared for an exchange of views with us as well. An exchange of views was Skorzeny's delicate way of saying that he agreed to full and comprehensive cooperation with Israel. Skorzeny demanded a price for his help. He wanted a valid Austrian passport issued in his real name, a writ of lifetime immunity from prosecution signed by Prime Minister Eshkol, and his immediate removal from Wiesenthal's list of wanted Nazis, as well as some money. Skorzeny's conditions sparked a sharp argument in the Mossad. Ahituv and Eitan saw in them an operational constraint and a requirement for the success of the operation. Other senior officials argued that they were an attempt by a Nazi criminal to cleanse his name, and they demanded a new look at Skorzeny's past. This new investigation revealed further details about the role he played on Kristallnacht, as the leader of one of the mobs that burned synagogues in Vienna, and that, until recently, he was an active supporter of neo-Nazi organizations. Meir Amit, practical and unemotional as always, thought that Eitan and Ahituv were right, but he needed the moral support of the Prime Minister. Levi Eshkol listened to Amit and consulted some of the high-ranking Mossad members who were Holocaust survivors, unlike Amit, Eitan, and Ahituv, who were not, hearing their vehement objections. Nevertheless, he finally approved giving Skorzeny money, a passport, and immunity. The Prime Minister also approved the request concerning Wiesenthal, but that wasn't his decision to make, nor the Mossad's. Wiesenthal was an opinionated and obstinate man, and although he had close links with the State of Israel and even the Mossad, which financed some of his operations, he wasn't an Israeli citizen, and he worked out of Vienna, outside of Israel's jurisdiction. In October 1964, Rafi Meydan met with Wiesenthal to discuss, without elaborating the details of the operation, why Skorzeny had to be removed from Wiesenthal's blacklist of Nazi criminals to be hunted down and prosecuted. "To my astonishment," Meydan recalled, Wiesenthal said, "Herr Meydan, there is not a chance. This is a Nazi and a war criminal, and we will never strike him from our list. No matter what I said or how I tried, he simply refused categorically." When told he would remain on Wiesenthal's list, Scorsese was disappointed, but agreed to the deal anyhow. Thus did the unbelievable come to pass. The Führer's favorite, wanted all over the world, as a Nazi war criminal who had apparently burned synagogues and taken part in SS operations, became a key agent in the most important operation waged by Israeli intelligence at the time. Skorzeny's first step was to send word to his friends among the scientists in Egypt that he was reviving a network of SS and Wehrmacht veterans to build a new Germany, in other words, to establish a Fourth Reich. To prepare the ground, he would tell them, his organization would have to gather information in secret. The German scientists working for NASA would thus be required, under their Wehrmacht oaths, to provide Skorzeny's phantom organization with the details of their missile research so it could be used by the new German military force in the making. At the same time, Skorzeny and Ahituv also masterminded a plan to get information out of the formidable security officer Hermann Valentin, who knew everything about the Egyptian missile project. Unlike with the recruitment of the sophisticated and experienced Skorzeny, who was aware he was dealing with a Mossad man and whom Ahituv never tried to mislead, the two decided to use some subterfuge on Valentin. Skorzeny played his part perfectly. He summoned Hermann Valentin to Madrid under the pretense that he was hosting a special gathering for his subordinates from the Glorious War. he put Valentin up at Mossad expense in a luxurious hotel and presented him with his phony plan for reviving the Reich. Then he revealed that this was not his only reason for the invitation to Madrid, and that he wanted him to meet a close friend, an officer of the British MI6 Secret Service. The British, he said, were interested in what was going on in Egypt, and he asked Valentin to help his friend. Valentin was suspicious. "Are you sure the Israelis aren't involved?" he asked. "Stand to attention when you're spoken to and apologize," Skrzeny fired back. "How dare you say something like that to your superior officer?" Valentin duly apologized, but he wasn't convinced. And he was, in fact, completely right. Skrzeny's friend was no Brit, but an Australian-born case officer in the Mossad by the name of Harry Barak. Valentin agreed to meet him, but not to cooperate, and the meeting between the two led nowhere. The resourceful Skrzeny immediately came up with a solution. At his next meeting with Valentin, he told him that his friend from MI6 had reminded him that a cable Skrzeny had sent close to the end of the war, in which he notified the general staff that he was promoting Valentin, had not reached the general staff or Valentin. Valentin's eyes lit up. Though this retroactive promotion was now purely symbolic, it clearly meant a lot to him. He stood up and gave the Heil Hitler salute and thanked Skrzeny profusely. Skrzeny told Valentin that he was ready to give him a written document confirming that he had been promoted. Valentin was grateful to his new friend from British intelligence for the information he had provided, and agreed to help him as much as he wanted. In time, Skrzeny invited other former Wehrmacht officers involved in the missile project to Madrid. They attended lavish parties at his home, billed as gatherings of Waffen-SS Special Forces veterans. His guests ate, drank, and enjoyed themselves late into the night, never knowing that the Israeli government was paying for their food and drinks, and bugging their conversations. The information provided by Skrzeny, Valentin, and the scientists who came to Madrid solved most of the Mossad's information problem regarding Egypt's missile program. It identified precisely who was involved in the project and exactly what the current status of each component was. Thanks to the new wealth of information from this operation, Meir Amitz Mossad managed to crumble Egypt's missile project from the inside, using a number of methods in parallel. One was the dispatch of threatening letters to many of the German scientists. They were very cleverly worded, based on top-grade intelligence provided by Valentin, and included intimate details about the recipients. Remember that even if you are not to blame for the crimes of the German nation in the past, you will not be able to deny your responsibility for your deeds today. You had better consider very seriously the contents of this letter, for the sake of your future and the future of your young family. The Gideons was the name of the unknown organization that signed the letters. Meanwhile, thanks to new intelligence from its sources, primarily Valentin, the Mossad was able to identify a secret Egyptian plan to recruit scores of workers from the Heliga aircraft and rocket factory in Freiburg, who were about to be dismissed. Amit decided to take advantage of the momentum to carry out a quick move aimed at preventing their departure for Egypt. On the morning of December 9, Shimon Peres, then Deputy Defense Minister, and Rafi Maidan carried a locked case containing a number of documents in English that had been prepared by the Mossad director's office based on materials supplied by Skrzeny, Valentin, and the scientists who came to Madrid, and flew off for a hurriedly arranged meeting with one of West Germany's senior politicians, former Defense Minister Franz Josef Strauss. Peres and Strauss were architects of the restitution agreement between West Germany and Israel. Strauss rose from his seat to greet the two Israelis, and he and Peres embraced warmly. "We sat for 6 hours," Peres said. "God, that man could drink. Wines from all over the world, and beer. I can also drink, but quantities like that. 6 hours, and we didn't stop drinking." The information Peres presented to Strauss was far more detailed, cross-checked, authentic, and grave than anything that had been presented to the Germans previously. "It is inconceivable that German scientists would help our worst enemy in such a manner. while you stand idly by, Peres told Strauss, who must have grasped what the leakage of this material to the international press would have meant. Strauss looked at the documents and agreed to intervene. He called Ludwig Bulko, a powerful figure in the German aerospace industry, and asked for his help. Bulko sent his representatives to offer the Heliga scientists and engineers jobs under good conditions at his plants, as long as they'd promise not to help the Egyptians. The plan worked. Most of the new group never went to Egypt, where the missile program urgently needed their assistance with the bulky guidance systems, a development that fatally crippled the project. The final blow came when a representative of Bulko's arrived in Egypt to persuade the scientists already working there to come home. One by one, they deserted the program, and by July 1965, even Pilz was gone, having returned to Germany to head one of Bulko's airplane component divisions. The German scientists' affair was the first time the Mossad mobilized all of its forces to stop what it perceived as an existential threat from an adversary, and the first time Israel allowed itself to target civilians from countries with which it had diplomatic relations. Given the newly raised stakes, a 1982 top-secret internal report was written, analyzing whether it would have been possible to resolve the affair using soft methods, generous offers of money from the government of Germany to the scientists, without the mysterious disappearance of Krug, or the bomb that maimed Hannelore Wende, or the other letter bombs and the intimidation. The report concluded that it would not have been possible. The Mossad believed that, without the threat of violence directed at them, the German scientists would not have been willing to accept the money and give up on the project. Chapter 6. A Series of Catastrophes. After the German scientists' affair, the Mossad was on a roll. Meir Amit brought in more professionals from the military, introduced new technologies, and strengthened links with intelligence services abroad. He also continued to set in motion numerous organizational reforms. Amit wanted to establish a single operations division in the Mossad, which would bring all of the units dealing with sabotage, targeted killings, and espionage in the Arab countries under one umbrella. In order to do this, Amit did what Harel had tried to do for years, and he, Amit, had opposed. He transferred Unit 188 from Amman to the Mossad and merged it with Shamir's Mifratz. Yosef Yariv was appointed head of the division, with Shamir as his deputy. The Mossad chief named the division Caesarea, after the Roman city on the Mediterranean coast, another example of the Israeli intelligence community's penchant for code names taken from the country's ancient history. The network of Caesarea activities outside of Israel was codenamed the Senate. Amit also wanted his own intelligence division. Until recently, the same unit, the Birds, had served both the Shin Bet and the Mossad. Amit now decided that he wanted a separate unit that would work only outside of Israel and only for the Mossad. He co-opted some of the Birds unit's personnel for a new intelligence unit, which he named Colossus. In addition to these bureaucratic changes, under Amit, the agency carried out operations that garnered unprecedented amounts of information about the Arab states and their military services. One of the most outstanding of these was Operation Diamond, in which Junction recruited an Iraqi pilot, Munir Redfa, who defected to Israel with his brand new MiG-21 fighter plane, the most advanced and threatening attack weapon in the hands of the Soviet bloc at the time. The Israeli Air Force was now able to prepare to cope with its most powerful adversary in future aerial combat. The Pentagon was very eager to learn the secrets of the plane, and Amit gave the Americans not just the blueprints for the MiG, but the plane itself, fully equipped and with a trained pilot. Amit had also assiduously cultivated Israel's secret relations with Morocco, in line with the periphery doctrine. Though Morocco was an Arab country, in close contact with Israel's main enemies, it also was moderate and had no territorial dispute with Israel. Furthermore, its leader was the relatively pro-Western King Hassan II. Morocco received valuable intelligence and technological assistance from Israel, and in exchange, Hassan allowed Morocco's Jews to immigrate to Israel, and the Mossad received the right to establish a permanent station in the capital, Rabat, from which it could spy on Arab countries. The height of the cooperation came in September 1965, when the king allowed a Mossad team led by Zvi Malchin and Rafi Eitan to bug all the meeting rooms and private suites of the leaders of the Arab states and their military commanders during an Arab summit in Casablanca. The purpose of the summit was to discuss the establishment of a joint common Arab command in future wars with Israel. But King Hassan's relations with some of the other Arab rulers were shaky, and he feared that some of them were acting to depose him, so he let the Mossad listen in. This gave Israel an unprecedented glimpse of the military and intelligence secrets of its greatest enemies, and of the mindsets of those countries' leaders. At that summit, commanders of the Arab armies reported that their forces were not prepared for a new war against Israel, information that was the basis of the Israeli military's supreme confidence when they urged Prime Minister Eshkol to go to war 2 years later, in June 1967. This sensational material, a Mossad report stated, was one of the highlights of the achievements of Israeli intelligence since its foundation. These successful operations provided the IDF with the critical intelligence it needed to prepare for the next war. But then, at a dizzying pace, one catastrophe after another hit Amit and his organization. The top spy for Unit 188, and now Kasaria, was Eli Cohen, who'd penetrated the ruling circles in Damascus and provided the information that enabled the Mossad to locate the Nazi Alois Brunner and send him a letter bomb. Cohen was originally assigned to serve as a sleeper agent who, rather than collect and convey information, would become active only if he had to alert Israel that Syria was planning to launch a surprise attack against it. However, under pressure from his operators, and having become deeply enmeshed with and overconfident in his own cover story, he started broadcasting messages to his Mossad handlers on a daily basis, using a telegraphic device he kept hidden at his apartment. He reported on secret military installations, Syria's plot to take control of the region's water sources, with the assistance of a Saudi contracting firm headed by Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, and Syria's relationship with the Soviet Union, but also on Nazis' holdup in Damascus, parliamentary gossip, and accounts of government power struggles. Cohen's transmission of information of this nature and at this frequency was a serious and unprofessional error, on his own part, but also, more important, on the part of his handlers. Eli Cohen was one of the people who went through life walking sideways, said Moti Kfir, who, among other Mossad jobs, served as head of its training program in the early 1960s. When you are sideways, sometimes you think that no one sees you. But he was wrong. He became too prominent. I told him during training, never be the life of the party. But he did the opposite. The letter bomb sent to Brunner and the lively interest that Cohen showed in other Nazis in talks with top Syrians, along with the fact that he was in an unusual situation, an immigrant without a job who was giving parties, mixing with high society, and providing his guests and friends entertainment of all kinds. But the Syrian intelligence service is on the alert, and led one of his interlocutors to doubt the cover story of Kamal Amin Tabet, a wealthy Syrian merchant who'd returned to his homeland after long years of exile in Buenos Aires. In a tragic coincidence for Cohen, during the same period, his transmitter caused interference with broadcasts from the Syrian General Staff headquarters, across the street from the luxurious apartment he rented, and in which he held wild parties for Syrian high officials. Puzzled, the Syrians asked GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence, to investigate. The Russians sent in special prowl cars, which managed to lock into the signals emanating from Cohen's transmitter during one of his broadcasts. Cohen was arrested, brutally tortured, quickly tried, and sentenced to death. He was hanged in public in the central square of Damascus on May 18. His body was left dangling on the gallows, draped in a white sheet bearing the text of his death sentence, as a message to the state of Israel. The man who had recruited, trained, and operated Cohen, Gedaliah Chalaf, later said, "I looked at him, at my Eli, on Syrian television, and I saw in his face the diabolical torments he had undergone. I didn't know what to do with myself. I wanted to scream, to do something, to take a pistol and break into the Meza prison, to bang my head against the wall until it broke, until we could save him. And they killed him, and we could do nothing but stand there and watch." Amitz Mossad, so freshly confident, was humiliated, impotent. Worse, the Mossad was exposed. The Syrians had tortured Cohen so severely, yanking out his fingernails, electrifying his testicles, that he'd broken. He revealed the secret communication codes and deciphered 200 messages that he'd sent and the Syrians had picked up, but hadn't been able to read. And he told them what he knew about Israeli intelligence's recruitment, training, and cover-building methods. Shortly after Cohen was caught, Caesarea was hit by another disaster. Wolfgang Lotz, the Caesarea spy in Cairo's high society, a key element in the intelligence gathering for the attempts to kill the German scientists in Egypt, was also uncovered on February 10, 1965. His downfall also came from excessive activity, overconfidence in his cover story, and a number of crude errors that he and his handlers made. The only thing that saved Lotz from suffering the same fate as Eli Cohen was the intervention of the BND, the German espionage service, which responded to Israel's request and told the Egyptians that Lotz was also working for them. Lotz and his wife, Waltrud, were spared the gallows and sentenced to life in prison. They were later released in a prisoner exchange following the Six-Day War in 1967. But this was another hard blow for the Mossad. For fear of further losses, Yosef Yariv ordered his other spies, whose training and cover stories had cost many years of effort, to come home. Caesarea, barely out of its infancy, was nearly in ruins. Prime Minister Eshkol regarded the downfall of the two spies as a national disaster, but despite the bad state the Mossad was in, Eshkol decided to approve a special targeted killing mission by Caesarea in Uruguay anyway. 2 months prior, a conference attended by representatives of the various intelligence agencies had been held to discuss the state of the hunt for Nazis, a matter that was not high on the list of priorities. Rafi Maidan, deputy chief of the Amal unit, which handled the issue, surveyed the possible targets for assassination on the list from which the name of Ados Korzeny had just been erased. When he came to the name of Herbert Kukors, a Latvian Nazi war criminal who, as an aviator, had volunteered to assist the SS and the Gestapo, and began describing his horrific acts, a loud thud was heard. The head of Amman, the Military Intelligence Directorate, Major General Aharon Yariv, had collapsed, and it took some time before he came to. Kukors, it emerged, had burned alive some of Yariv's relatives and friends. After the conference, Amit, who was very close to Yariv and deeply affected by the incident, went to see Prime Minister Eshkol and received permission to have Kukors eliminated. Kukors had killed Jews for sport. He had gunned them down on city streets after telling them to run for their lives. He had locked Jews in synagogues he then set on fire, drinking whiskey as he listened to the screams. Holocaust survivors called him the Butcher of Riga, and his name came up frequently at the Nuremberg war crimes trials as directly involved in the murder of some 15,000 Jews, and indirectly in the killing of 20,000 more. But after the war, he had managed to escape and find refuge in Brazil, where he developed a tourism business, surrounding himself with security guards for fear of the same fate that befell Eichmann. Yaakov Meidad, a Caesarea operative who spoke Spanish and German, posed as an Austrian businessman seeking openings in the tourism industry in South America, and managed to persuade Kukors to go to Uruguay to meet a group of developers at a luxurious mansion outside Montevideo. At the mansion, three assassins would lie in wait. The plan was for Meidad to enter first, followed by Kukors. One of the assassins would shove him inside and close the door behind him. Then, when the Mossad team was out of the line of fire, he would shoot him. The job, however, did not go as smoothly as planned. Kukrz was alert and feared a trap. The moment he entered, he grasped what was happening and made a break for it. Yariv tried to get a stranglehold on him as another Israeli dragged him inside. "The fact that Kukrz was frightened to death," said Nedad, "and had lived in dread of this moment for 20 years, gave him superhuman strength. He managed to knock the guy down. He grabbed the doorknob and, had it not been for the three of us, including me, holding the door shut, he would have been able to get out." Kukrz bit hard into one of Yariv's fingers, cutting off the tip, which remained in his mouth. Yariv screamed in pain and had to loosen his grip on Kukrz's neck. He almost broke free, but at the last moment one of the hitmen, Ze'ev Amit, a cousin of the Mossad director, who had not been able to fire because of the danger to his comrades, picked up a hammer and smashed it into Kukrz's head again and again until he passed out. Then the third assassin, Eliezer Sadit Sharon, formerly the chief hitman for the Irgun, fired 2 shots into the mass murderer, assuring that he was dead. The operatives put the body into a suitcase, which they left in the mansion, and added on top a verdict, a sheet of paper inscribed with the words, "In consideration of his personal responsibility for the murder of 30,000 Jews with horrible brutality, the condemned man has been executed," signed, "Those Who Will Never Forget." Inside the Mossad, the operation was officially deemed a success, but the truth was that the unprofessional implementation could easily have led to disaster. Either way, Yariv was left with half a finger. The man who had crushed Kukrz's head with a hammer, Ze'ev Amit, suffered from horrific nightmares for the rest of his life, haunted by the trauma of the murder. The next disaster almost cost Prime Minister Eshkol and Director Amit their jobs. On September 30, 1965, 1 day after the Mossad received the vitally important tapes from the Arab summit, one of the commanders of the Moroccan intelligence service, Ahmed Limi, contacted the Mossad and made it clear that the Moroccans wanted the debt for this valuable information repaid as soon as possible. In the intelligence world, there are no free gifts. Amit reported to Eshkol, "On the one hand, they've given us these tapes, but on the other, they've said, give. They want something very simple. There's this goy, Ben Barka, who's in the opposition to the king, and the king has given an order to wipe him out. They've come to us and said, you're great killers. Do it." The opposition leader, Mehdi Ben Barka, had been exiled from Morocco at the beginning of the 1960s and later sentenced to death in absentia. Moroccan intelligence tried to locate him, but Ben Barka was careful to conceal his location, moving from place to place, using pseudonyms. The heads of the Moroccan secret services asked the Mossad to help find, trap, and kill him. "We faced a dilemma," Amit recalled. "Either help and get drawn in, or refuse and endanger the national achievements of the highest order." Years later, Amit tried to paint a picture of himself having chosen to walk between the raindrops, and not to directly abet the killing, but to incorporate it, the aid to the Moroccans, into our regular joint activities with them. But a close look at Mossad internal cables and records shows that the organization was deeply involved. Caesarea and Colossus helped the Moroccans pinpoint the kiosk in Geneva to which Ben Barka had his magazines mailed, enabling them to place him under surveillance. Later, they proposed a plan whereby Ben Barka would be lured to Paris by a man posing as a documentary filmmaker, fascinated by the Moroccan exile's life story and interested in making a film about it. The Mossad supplied the Moroccans with safe houses in Paris, vehicles, fake passports, and 2 different kinds of poison with which to kill him, as well as shovels and something to disguise the traces. When Ben Barka came to Paris on October 29, 1965, the Moroccans kidnapped him with the help of corrupt French police officers. He was taken to an empty Mossad safe house, where the Moroccans began brutally interrogating him. He died not long afterward from asphyxiation, after repeatedly being submerged in the bath of filthy water. Mossad operatives were not involved or present when the killing took place, but they took it upon themselves to handle the corpse. A joint team from Caesarea and Colossus were moving it to the nearby Saint-Germain forest. They dug a deep hole in the ground and buried the body, after which they scattered chemical powder, which was designed to consume the body and is particularly active when it comes into contact with water. Heavy rain fell almost immediately, so there was probably not much left of Ben Barka shortly afterward. What was left, according to some of the Israelis involved, was moved again, and today lies beneath the road to the recently constructed ultra-modern Louis Vuitton Foundation, or even under the building itself. Amit had promised Eshkol, "I won't take any steps without telling you," but then told him about only part of the truth and only after the fact. On November 25, 1965, Amit told Eshkol, "Everything is fine." In truth, however, everything was not fine. The fact that Ben Barka had disappeared in Paris and that the heads of Moroccan intelligence and French mercenaries were involved exploded into the French media with a great bang and stayed in the headlines for a long time. President Charles de Gaulle disbanded his intelligence services and prosecuted some of those involved. When King Hassan refused to hand over the heads of his spy agencies to stand trial, de Gaulle angrily cut off diplomatic relations with Morocco. The fallout from the operation has lasted for decades and left a dark shadow on relations between Morocco and France, where there is still an investigating magistrate in charge of the case. The probes raised suspicions against Mossad personnel, too, and all those involved left Paris in a hurry. For many years, they remained at risk of facing trial. Isser Harel was serving at the time as Eshkol's advisor on intelligence. Bitter and frustrated over the way he had been ousted from the directorship of the Mossad, and envious of the successful Amit, Harel got hold of the pertinent documents on the Ben Barka affair and went to war against Amit. In a lengthy report he submitted to the Prime Minister, he declared, "The Mossad, and through it the state, were engaged in various actions connected to a political assassination in which Israel not only had no interest, but should not have, I believe, from a moral, public, and international perspective, been involved at all." Harel demanded that Eshkol fire Amit and send a personal emissary to tell the truth to de Gaulle. Eshkol refused, and Harel accused the Prime Minister of becoming involved in the murder himself and demanded that he resign forthwith. He threatened Eshkol, saying that the echoes of the affair will come to the attention of the public and the entire party, Labour, will be tainted with the shame. When that didn't work, he leaked the gist of the story to a sensationalist Yellow Weekly, and when the censor blocked the publication, he informed high-ranking party members of the details and urged them to rebel against Eshkol's leadership. These members then tried to persuade Golda Meir to lead a coup against Eshkol. Meir agreed that Amit must go, but she drew the line at ousting the Prime Minister. "I should topple Eshkol and take his place?" she asked the conspirators, with the pathos for which she was famous. "I would rather throw myself into the sea." When Harel's vitriolic attacks did not subside, Eshkol and Amit decided to fight back, combating extortion with counter-extortion. Amit told his close associates, "Harel will not drop the subject of his own accord, unless it is hinted to him that in his past there is enough material to undermine his claim that he is the moral guardian of the Mossad." And indeed, there was enough material. Amit had Alexander Yisraeli's file brought back up from the archives. Yisraeli was the naval officer who had sold secrets to Egypt in 1954, and then was abducted, with the intent of bringing him to trial, though he died in transit of an overdose of sedatives. Harel had ordered his body to be thrown into the sea, and for his family to be told he'd settled in South America. Amit gave Yisraeli's file to a veteran of the Mossad who despised Harel, was friendly with Amit, and knew about the affair. That person summoned Harel for a meeting. "What do you think would happen if this affair became public?" the man asked Harel. "Don't you think such a serious matter would require a thorough examination and an intense investigation?" "Of course we will try to keep the story quiet, but we are not the only ones who know it," And it's outrageous what comes to the attention of journalists these days. Harrell understood the situation. Shortly afterward, he resigned. For Amit, the main lesson of the affair was that we must never get involved in carrying out sensitive tasks of others in which we do not have a direct interest, especially not assassinations. We must kill someone only if he is threatening Israel's interests, and the execution, only blue and white. A reference to the colors of the Israeli flag, by which he meant only by Israelis. All these catastrophes left the agency, and particularly Caesarea, its spearhead, bruised and confused. Amit set up a number of inquiry panels to try to analyze what had gone wrong. The predominant figure conducting these inquiries was Mikael Mike Harari. When their work was completed, Amit named Harari the deputy head of Caesarea. Harari served in this position for 5 years, first under Yosef Yariv, and then under Zvi Aharoni. But in practice, he was the living spirit of the division and, in effect, commanded it. In 1970, he was made head of Caesarea, a position he held for 10 years. The 15 years during which he led the division were the most important and turbulent in its history. Harari was nicknamed Caesar and became the figure with the most profound influence on the world of the Mossad's special operations. Harari was born in Tel Aviv in 1927. Two events shaped my life, he said. In 1936, while still a child, he witnessed the violent riots by Palestine's Arabs against the Jews and the British, which later became known as the Palestinian Revolt. I saw the rioting mob in a burned-out British jeep with the charred body of the sergeant still gripping the steering wheel. When he saw Arabs and Jews fighting, he says, he did not hold back, but went into a nearby store and chose what looked like the best weapon, a hefty pick handle, and went to join the battle against the Arabs. The second defining experience occurred in 1942, when he went down to play in the street and arrived on the scene a few minutes after officers of the British police's CID had shot dead Avraham Stern, the commander of the extremist Jewish underground group, Lehi. I saw them bringing the body down. Then I went upstairs. I was a boy and no one stopped me. I went into the apartment and saw the closet he had hidden in. These things affect you. In 1943, he lied about his age to join the Palmach, the secret army of the Jewish Yeshuv in Palestine. It was underground. It was secret. It intrigued me. He took part in many actions, including the sabotage of railroad lines and bridges, attacks on British police stations, and intelligence collecting. He was arrested several times by the CID. After World War II, when the Haganah Command learned that Harari spoke a few languages, he was sent to Europe to help with the transportation of the surviving Jewish refugees to Israel. He was involved in the secret acquisition of ships and the complicated logistics involved in moving these illegal immigrants through the ruins of Europe to the boats, then smuggling them into Palestine under the noses of the British. That was the period during which I created for myself the criteria and the methods for covert activities abroad, the tools that I used later on in the Mossad. After the establishment of the state, Esser Harel recruited Harari to the Shin Bet and then the Mossad, where he rose rapidly before being assigned to investigate Caesarea's operations. What he found was a unit in very bad shape, with a hodgepodge of personnel, former members of 188 Mifrats and the Birds, the operational unit of the Shin Bet, among others, a fuzzy combat doctrine, and undefined goals. Caesarea's string of failures led Harari to the conclusion that Caesarea must be rebuilt from the bottom up, with its objectives, tasks, and personnel redefined. After several months of work, he submitted his doctrine to the heads of the Mossad. In my view of the world, I believe that any country that wants to live must have a Caesarea of its own, a clandestine, compartmentalized, and elite body that will be able to carry out, beyond the country's borders, the things that no other agency in the country is able to do. It is a unique tool our leadership can use to operate against the country's enemies. Harari is set Kasaria's primary